Mr. Speaker.
Order, order.
Parliament resumes at 2 on Tuesday after a week's break. They'll be sitting for 2 weeks before the start of an adjournment on Thursday, July the 7th, that extends for the next 4 weeks through to Tuesday, August the 9th. This Tuesday, though, will begin as usual with question time, and then I wouldn't be surprised if there was a request for a snap debate on the government's decision to extend the deployment of New Zealand troops in Iraq for another 18 months. And for a look ahead at the rest of the week, here's the Leader of the House.
The Honourable Gerry Brownlee.
Mr. Speaker, when the House resumes on Tuesday, the 28th of June, the government will look to complete the Appropriation 2015-16 Supplementary Estimates Bill, the Impress Supply First for 2016-17 Bill, and a number of other bills in the order paper. Wednesday will be a Members' Day.
The Leader of the House, Gerry Brownlee, he's also the Minister of Defence, so we'll probably be hearing more from him in that capacity. As for the week just passed, there were just a couple of select committee meetings, while the Social Services Committee went on a series of site visits around Christchurch on Tuesday. For more on those committee meetings, here's Rhys Lyon.
Select Committee scrutiny of the government's budget takes place each year soon after Budget Day, with areas of spending, known as votes, divided up by the Finance and Expenditure Committee and sent off to the relevant committees to look at in detail. The hearings are conducted in public and feature ministers fronting up to defend their ministry's spending plans. With Parliament adjourned for the week, only one such meeting was held, with the Commerce Committee taking 45 minutes on Monday afternoon to review this year's budget allocation for Vote Tourism. The Minister for Tourism is the Prime Minister, John Key, but he's usually running his Cabinet meeting on a Monday afternoon, followed by a post-Cabinet press conference. And so the job of explaining this year's budget funding for Mr. Key's portfolio of tourism fell to his Associate Minister, Paula Bennett, who outlined some industry statistics, including an 11% increase in visitor arrivals to New Zealand in the first 4 months of the year.
You know, to give you an idea, that 11% means an increase of 312,500 people. 312,500 actual people is that kind of increase that we're talking about of 11%. The biggest increase is by country of residence, so China up 88,100, so that's the growth there. Australia, very close, second at 87,100, and the United States up 24,400. So holidaymakers made up just over half the visitors who arrived in April, and friends and relatives, visits to friends and relatives was second. So we're just seeing a huge, huge uptake there. As you could see, that $10 billion international visitors spending, and we've got a huge market in that domestic markets going up as well, which is quite exciting because they often go to different parts of the country.
When it came to questions to the Associate Tourism Minister from Commerce Committee members, Labour's Chris Farfoy pointed to statistics suggesting a 36,000-person workforce shortage in the tourism industry and asked what the government was doing to address that.
So it is still the latest number that we've got is 36,000. Additional full-time equivalent workers will need to be directly employed in the tourism sector, but that's, as I say, directly employed and not taking in those other businesses that support the tourism sector as such. So we've got a whole suite of kind of activities that are going on between the Tourism Industry Association, the government-led itself, and it is going to have to be supplemented, though, by an overseas workforce that are here on work visas. So I don't know the number on that, and I don't think we've got one. But what I would say to you is that every tourism operator or employer you speak to would rather be employing a New Zealander.
Paula Bennett was also asked about an apparent shortage of accommodation in Queenstown.
So worker accommodation is certainly an issue for Queenstown, let alone kind of house prices and everything else. So we have been, I was there just a few weeks ago and was discussing it with them. There's a range of views from that government should be building all the houses for the workers and paying for them all. I sort of felt like the rest of New Zealand has probably got more pressing issues at the moment. to be really honest with you, with the bit of the housing head on as well that you can't help having, I did say to the business chamber down there that I felt that they were the best resourced and the best and the most and some of our most intelligent people in the country, and they could sort their problem out without huge government. It wouldn't be where the government would be choosing to invest housing money right now, to be quite blunt.
There are also questions from the government side of the committee table, including one from National's Kanwaljit Singh Bakshi, about how the tourism industry was targeting and catering to visitors from India. Sitting alongside the Associate Minister with details to hand on the Indian market was Tourism New Zealand Chief Executive Kevin Bowler.
We're really pleased with the performance from India. We're, in the last 5 years, the market's doubled in size. We're nearly 50,000 visitors now. Our principal focus is on Dubai. Mumbai, and we are increasingly looking at Delhi as an opportunity for extending our marketing reach. A lot of our activity is done through digital marketing. It's aimed at upper-income professionals in those large metropolitan cities and capitalises on the fact that those visitors prefer to come to New Zealand in our spring and our autumn periods, which fits our profile perfectly for when we want to see increased visitation. The other good thing about India, which is continues to play out really strongly for us, is the Indian visitors participate in a lot of activities and they're quite high spenders while they're in New Zealand. So our program is focused on a range of different demographics, from professionals as well as families, and we've had good success, particularly leveraging celebrities in India as one way of getting a lot of impact in that market.
Mr. Singh Bakshi also asked if there were any plans for direct flights between New Zealand and India.
I don't think there's any likelihood in the short term that we'll be fortunate enough to get a direct air service. But I do think in the medium term there is that prospect. What we are seeing, though, is a strengthening of air connectivity in terms of one-stop connections. So one-stop connections through Dubai, one-stop connections through Bangkok, through Malaysia and through Singapore. So we're seeing a lot of that expansion and capacity on the basis that yes, you'll need to do one stop to get to New Zealand. So that's from our perspective promising, and it's not putting a blockage on the demand that we were experiencing, say, 2 or 3 years ago, where air capacity was a really big issue.
And in response to questions stemming from Paula Bennett's earlier statements about growing Chinese tourism, the Associate Minister suggested the industry shouldn't over-cater to that market.
Because what I often say to them is to make sure that we still give them a New Zealand experience. That we actually don't, you know, we sort of don't get so caught in trying to make them feel so comfortable that actually, you know, they haven't left their own country. They've come to New Zealand for a New Zealand experience, and we should ensure that we're actually giving them all of that. But that doesn't mean that we have that we need to lower our expectations on quality. But yeah, we don't want to turn into a kind of our hotels all looking the same and everyone sort of getting the same experience that they might anywhere else in the world.
Also appearing alongside Paula Bennett was Ministry of Business, Innovation and Employment Tourism Manager Lisa Barrett, who said MB had been doing some China market research.
Which has done quite an extensive look at the qualitative and quantitative information around what Chinese people want when they come to New Zealand. What we've done is we've taken that research and we've actually been disseminating it through a series of workshops throughout New Zealand, where we've had both tourism operators along with people from the regional tourism organisations and anyone who wants to participate really to come along and hear what the key findings are. It's been really well received from what we've heard. And it's some interesting stuff coming through around sort of changing demographic of that group. We're seeing more family groups coming. They're actually wanting to come and repeat their visit to New Zealand again. Also a bit more interest in adventure activities and that kind of stuff, which is interesting, and it's a change from what we've seen before.
And Paula Bennett had a theory on that.
A big part of it is with the one-child policy for so long that there was actually some concern that those children are getting a little bit mollycoddled, and so they bring to New Zealand and they literally want them to have more of the adventure activities. One operator was saying they've got more Chinese visitors that are kind of doing the 1 or 2 nights camping because they want their children to really experience the great outdoors and not think that it's all flash hotels and good restaurants, that actually there's an outdoor element to it as well.
Associate Tourism Minister Paula Bennett speaking to the Commerce Committee during its review of this year's budget allocation for Vote Tourism.
That report from Rhys Lyon. On Wednesday, the Transport and Industrial Relations Committee met in the Gene Batten Room at Auckland Airport's Holiday Inn to continue hearing submissions on its inquiry into the future of New Zealand's mobility. One of those submissions came from representatives of ride-sharing app Uber, led by its public policy associate, Ben Brooks.
What we're here to talk about is ride-sharing, and ride-sharing has become the accepted nomenclature for basically just the use of your existing personal vehicle to provide some rides. Uber is a technology company that facilitates ride-sharing in probably close to 500 cities worldwide now through its app platform. So essentially the way it works is a rider, a member of the public, will register their payment details, their credit card, PayPal account through the app, including their contact details. The app will connect them to a registered driver partner, and it will direct that driver to pick up the person, conduct the trip. The app provides in-trip navigation advice. And then at the end of the trip, the app will facilitate a cashless and automatic transaction. So that's essentially how the model works.
Ben Brooks outlined how ride-sharing was contributing to existing urban transport networks.
We see ourselves as supplementing public transport. So I think we flagged in that submission, and we've confirmed it subsequently as well, that about half our trips, or just under half of the trips that we conduct in Auckland and Wellington, are what we would describe as being to or from a public transport desert. So these are areas that are more than 800 metres away from a medium frequency transport node. And many of those trips are to or from transport nodes themselves, so to or from the rail station.
Mr. Brooks said that rather than impinging on what he called the, quote, incumbent point-to-point industry, otherwise known as taxis, ride-sharing was servicing an entirely new market.
Very much servicing consumers who would not otherwise take a taxi to get from A to B. The majority of trips in Sydney, for instance, are people who would not otherwise take a taxi to conduct the equivalent journey. The New South Wales Economic Regulator, just last week, I think it was, released some data that shows that since ride-sharing first entered the market, and since the government regulated ride-sharing, taxi demand has increased progressively over that period.
And while Uber was scheduled to be the last submission of the day, that slot ended up going to latecomer David Wilmot, the co-director for the Centre for Urban and Transport Studies.
Firstly, my apologies for taking an hour and 20 minutes to get here instead of the hour I allowed on the presumption that it should and would take me 50 minutes when it should take 40 minutes. That is the state of Auckland Transport today.
David Wilmot speculated on the cause of that situation.
Auckland Transport is in the business of being told to promote public transport by usurping multi-purpose road lanes for single-purpose bus use, for example, where the space between those buses can accommodate 300 cars. The Northern Busway, for example, if you stand on an overbridge and look both ways in the peak hour, you will see a bus about five-minute intervals. Alongside that, you'll see a congested motorway.
Mr. Wilmot wasn't confident about finding a solution to Auckland's transport issues.
I don't expect this government, given its past record, or any other government, given their past records, to grapple with this problem effectively. This committee is wasting its time if it thinks it merely needs to legislate for change, and that change will occur. If it merely thinks its job is to predict future technology and then to provide for that technology alone, because the history of the world shows that the future is unknown and can take a whole variety of courses.
Co-director for the Centre for Urban and Transport Studies, David Wilmot. Another submission came from the Blind Foundation's Neil Jarvis.
Disabled people are frequently described as isolated. And it isn't just because they can't get out of the house because there are steps at the house or something like that. That might be the case. But the real reason is that the access to transport and other environmental systems which require vision, hearing or physical mobility is at best restricted and often downright impossible. If I take myself, for example, I can't read signs. So if there's a really critical bit of information being conveyed by a visual sign, it ain't being conveyed to me. So I'm going to miss that, and that might be quite important. We don't know when a bus is approaching. Well, we know when a bus is approaching, but we don't necessarily know if it's the right bus. Have you ever got on the wrong bus? It's quite fun, I can tell you. I've done it many times. And not only have I done that, got on the wrong bus, I've often got off at the wrong stop, even if it was the right bus. I mean, that's just unfair.
The Blind Foundation's Neil Jarvis with that submission to the Transport and Industrial Relations Committee's inquiry into the future of New Zealand's mobility. I'm Tom Frewin, and this program was made with funding from Parliament.